its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Live music in the studio tomorrow from Mahogany. We'll hear from Wayne Kuipers, the former state legislator, talking about energy or electric deregulation in Michigan. And it's already the first anniversary of the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. We will see where the Broad is at its first birthday. All of that tomorrow here on Current State. But first things first, events in Detroit have dominated a lot of Michigan news here in October, most noticeably the city's bankruptcy trial. That has not been enough, however, to overshadow the race for mayor and city council. Joining us to review and update that and several other of October's biggest Michigan news stories, Tim Skubick, the host of Off the Record, seen on WKAR-TV and online.
Buenos dias.
Tim, good to see you.
I decided to do the show in Spanish. Is that okay?
No, that's a...
Subtitles?
A wonderful touch. Susan Demas is starting her last day before officially becoming the owner of Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter, and she is back with us. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
And John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, recently returned from 2 weeks in Ireland. Welcome back, John.
And Paris.
And Paris.
Top
of the morning.
Doing it in French?
we're trilingual.
That's right, yeah. Well,
that is quite a combination, Ireland and France. That is getting both ends of Europe.
And there's a strong historical connection between the two, which I'll let you go get a book and find out.
Oh, okay,
about,
so. Very good. We'll Google that here in just a few minutes. Let's look at a bill in the news today at the Capitol that impacts Ingham County in particular. A week or so ago, Senator Rick Jones, the Grand Ledge Republican, introduced a pair of bills that would rework the state's Court of Claims. Now, this is the court that handles legal actions against the state. And the reason this would impact Ingham County so much is that those duties are currently handled by Ingham County Circuit Court judges. We should point out that the bill passed the Senate yesterday, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. But first, John Lindstrom, what is Senator Jones proposing here and why?
Well, in theory, what he's doing is talking about taking the Court of Claims out of the Ingham County Circuit Court, where it has always been since the new Constitution in 1963 was established, and creating a system whereby when you have a case, the Supreme Court would appoint members of the Court of Appeals to handle the actual litigation. And this is a fairly significant change because the Court of Claims handles a lot of stuff. Ingham County Circuit Court judges handle a lot of cases involving financial claims against the state. And this would specifically change that, put it into the Court of Appeals. From one standpoint, it changes the whole appeals process because you would have now one less potential appeal that a case could have. An appeal from the Court of Claims goes first to the Court of Appeals and then theoretically to the Supreme Court. Now it will go from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. But in many respects, the big issue here is that the Democrats are making a charge against, and one can make the argument that they're right, is that the Republicans are very unhappy with the Court of Claims structure as it is right now. Ingham County is a fairly strong Democratic county. A number of the judges in the circuit court system here in Ingham County have Democratic backgrounds. This court has been a key area of arguments on the right-to-work situation, on changes to state worker union programs have gone through this court, and so clearly Republicans are unhappy about that. And the fact that this is moving with such blinding speed certainly would indicate that there is a very strong partisan element to what's going on. Things only move this fast if there's a legitimate emergency that the state needs to act on, or if this is a partisan issue.
This helps explain to those of us who have always been a little bit confused why it is Ingham County judges determine so many statewide stories. How was it Judge Rosemary Aquilina was deciding issues affecting the state, or Bill Collette, or the Ingham County Circuit? This is the reason why. And the Court of Appeals is a more conservative body, isn't it?
Well, more Republican, but this ought to be called the James Giddings Memorial Bill, because Giddings is the one who sort of started this whole thing when John Engler was governor, which you guys remember. They had kind of a They had a thing, okay? And the Ingham County Court was always a target because they were making, quote, the wrong decisions as far as Governor Inglis was concerned. So I asked Senator Jones, I said, is this politically motivated? And he said, absolutely not.
He says the a judge, a staff, health care, et cetera, could cost a county $450,000 a year. So he makes the case that the county is already financially stressed. Its judges are overburdened. The Court of Appeals is just as qualified to take this over as anybody.
Well, at the same time, the legislature is Republican. The governor is Republican. He has faced an awful lot of lawsuits for various matters from the Detroit bankruptcy on down. And let's not forget that last December, Republicans did set a precedent with the right-to-work legislation where baked into that bill was that any litigation bypassed the circuit court level. So you were already a court of appeals. So this already was probably in the works back then.
So I mean, there is some logic. You could make the argument that why should one county's circuit court be the specific judge of all of these financial matters? Why specifically Ingham County as opposed to Wayne County or Kent County, for that matter?
Right.
Why, when the Constitution was set up, was there not a specific separate court set up to deal with financial claims against the state? But the fact that it's being handled in this manner and with this speed raises another point altogether, which Senator Jones says there's no political aspect to it. Well, maybe to Senator Jones there isn't, but to everyone else there is.
Senate Majority Leader Whitmer blasted the passage of the measure yesterday, saying her GOP colleagues are, quote, unnecessarily interfering with judicial oversight and rigging the system, unquote. Is it worth noting that several of these Ingham County judges have contributed to Senator Whitmer's campaigns?
Well, I mean, as the point was already made, a number of these judges have Democratic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And have they contributed to Senator Whitmer? Sure they have. But let's, you know, you go through the history of it. Judges contribute to all kinds of people. You've got a number of, as was pointed out recently, Judge Saad on the Court of Appeals gave, what was it, half of his salary, the equivalent of half of his salary to Republican candidates. Now, his family has his financial means, so he could afford to do that. But judges contribute to partisan candidates all the time, so that's in and of itself nothing new. Again, if this was really something very, very significant that people need to look at, yeah, you'd be taking a little more time than you're taking right now.
Legislatively, what's the prospects for this?
I assume it's a done deal.
Really? Susan?
I would assume so. You've got strong Republican majorities in both houses.
Yeah.
I would say that as a reporter, I'm not sure any politician has ever told me that they've done anything for political reasons. It's always for policy.
Okay. Worth noting. Let's visit where the Detroit bankruptcy trial is right now. We're stuck in the eligibility phase for longer than a lot of people hoped, including, it appears, Judge Stephen Rhodes, from frustration that he vented this week. What is slowing things down?
Well, you got a lot of people involved, okay? Everybody's got to have their day in court, and the guy who had his day in court on Monday was Snyder, wasn't that his name? Very unusual, very historic thing. I was not there for it, but I talked to some, at least one of the reporters who was there and read, of course, the accounts. And what the attorneys are trying to prove to keep the city, the unions, are trying to keep the city out of bankruptcy, and they're alleging that the Snyder administration from the get-go always wanted to send the city into bankruptcy and therefore did not negotiate in good faith. And the law basically says that in order to get into Chapter 9, you've had to go on through the process of at least trying to solve this problem without going into bankruptcy. And so that's really what the nif-gnawing is all about. And it will go on until the judge finally makes a ruling sometime in November, I would guess, and then we'll proceed from there.
Late last week, Free Press reporters Brent Snavely and Nate Bomey wrote, quote, there didn't appear to be any major surprises that could derail Detroit's eligibility for bankruptcy, unquote. Has anything happened this week to suggest that attorneys representing the unions and pension holders are scoring points?
Well, there was the issue that, you know, Governor Snyder did come out that he could have pursued a bankruptcy option that would have protected those pensions.
Yeah.
So I think that was news this week. I still think that probably the state feels pretty confident about where it's at.
Susan's right. That's the major issue that came out, was that there was an option looked at, or potentially could have been looked at and was rejected. And it's hard to say. I mean, it's interesting that Judge Rhodes is getting a little impatient. The reports that he told Kevin Orr,
step on it.
Yes, speed it up. When you're asked a yes or no question, basically answer yes or no and not go into a long flowery response. So,
does a much longer than anticipated trial benefit one side or the other?
I don't think so.
No,
it's hard to say.
Okay. In the meantime, we've got this interesting scenario whereby the Attorney General told the Detroit News, reiterated to the Detroit News yesterday, that it's his job to protect those workers' pensions because they are constitutionally protected in the state.
But it's also his job to present the other side, too, which is he's gotten some flack on that, but that's a long-held role of the Attorney General. In fact, I talked to the former Attorney General, Mr. Kelly, who said the genesis of this, of the AG representing both sides in a case in front of the court, which sounds counterintuitive, basically was the courts said to the Attorney General, we don't trust all the attorneys on the plaintiff and defense side, so why don't you give us both guys or ladies from your office, and then we know we're getting ethical information. So that's where that came from. It goes back a long time.
I don't know anybody who's played both sides since Goldman Sachs. You know, that's you just don't hear about this that often. But what's the takeaway from Governor Snyder's appearance this week, then?
As Tim said, very historic. He was extremely cautious in how he handled himself. How much you could glean from it, I don't know. I think the unions feel like they got a bit of a victory just getting him on the stand. But but how much? How much he contributed to the final product, we don't know at this point.
There was no smoking gun. That's what they were looking for. Look, I read the depo that he did for 3 hours. This was just basically a rehash of that. I had one reporter, Chad Livengood, I wrote him last night. I said, when I read the deposition, there were a lot of attorney-client privilege stuff and a lot of I don't recall. He said it was much more powerful when you saw him on the stand saying that stuff. Mm-hmm. It sort of amounted up to more of an evasive approach, whereas reading it was not quite the same thing. But look, this guy is a very slippery interview, and he's good. And he wasn't going to give – first of all, he says there's nothing to give them, okay? Mm-hmm. This was a last resort. I didn't want to send Detroit into bankruptcy. And he points to the consent agreement, which was a step before that, which simply didn't work out. The trigger, though, and this came out in both the depo and also his testimony, was the unions going into courts to try to wrap all and tie all of this stuff up for the next 3,000 years. That really pulled the trigger. They decided we better move, and we better move quickly on this in order to make sure we get this filing done.
That was the ballot measure.
No, not the ballot measure, filing. The filing by Mr. Orr had the letter queued up and teed up and ready to go to file for bankruptcy.
Oh, okay.
The governor says, hey, these guys are in court trying to stop us. Let's go. Am I reading that correctly, guys?
Yeah. There was discussion about when they were going to need to file, and they knew that the unions were going to try to do something. So it was just a matter of who moved first and when.
And this legal drama is playing out alongside the conclusion of an election campaign for mayor and city council in Detroit. In the mayor's race, Mike Duggan, well-established Wayne County guy, Detroit Medical Center executive, and County Sheriff Benny Napoleon are the mayoral candidates. Will Mike Duggan become the first white mayor of Detroit in 40 years or so, Susan?
Short of him confessing to a string of serial killings, I would say yes.
Yeah. What else do you take away from the mayoral campaign in Detroit alongside all of the bankruptcy drama?
Well, the interesting thing is Mr. Duggan has said, I will cooperate with Mr. Orr, and Mr. Napoleon says, I will not. And I believe that while there is a vocal minority in Detroit which is dead set against this bankruptcy, I think there is internal polling data that suggests the bulk of the people in Detroit are saying, as witnessed by their supporting of Mr. Duggan in the primary, we want a change. We want something different. Mm-hmm. And I think they're willing to go along with
and,
that.
And Mike Duggan, they have something different.
They do.
Uh-huh. Well, it's historic for a write-in candidate to be able to score a 20-point victory in the primary. And, you know, the race was all but over at that point because it doesn't really look like the sheriff ever put up much of a fight after that point. Mm-hmm. The polls have stayed remarkably consistent.
What do you make of it?
There seems to be an older element that is absolutely opposed to the idea of Mike Duggan and anybody cooperating with the bankruptcy and everything else going in, and another element that's just at a point, we need to get something done. we need to get something fixed, and so let's move ahead with that. And one point that hasn't been made a whole lot, it's not having to do with the mayoral election, but the council election, is, you know, now we're going to get council members who are elected from districts, which is going to be very, very significant, because for decades, everyone was elected at large, and you pretty much had a city council that reflected only a couple of areas in the city. So this could be a very significant thing. Once the city gets back into essentially self-governance, will you now start to see greater efforts being made in other neighborhoods because people now have actual representation on the council?
I'm really curious about that. Would you expect a more cohesive city council to emerge from this?
I mean,
the previous city council had a notorious reputation for dysfunction.
Right. I would expect that you're going to see a situation much like you would in the legislature or any other place. You're going to see coalitions build. You're going to see people try to make alliances on various things, because there are some areas of the city that have struggled far more than others.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that they aren't in control.
Well, that's right.
No, that's true. I mean, for the time being, what I'm saying is when they finally do get back under self-control.
What does it mean in the meantime? What will new faces matter as long as there's an emergency manager in the city?
Well, I think that John is right to bring up the neighborhoods issue, because that's more of a parochial thing for them to concentrate on, and that's been a huge theme with the city council elections, which, you know, have not gotten much attention, but that's where the mail pieces are at. That's what people are campaigning on. I want to take care of this neighborhood in Detroit, not just downtown. So mm-hmm. I would see that perhaps with having these representatives from, you know, certain areas of the city, they'll start to work on issues, you know, specific to their constituents.
It's Current State's Month in Review for October. I'm joined by Tim Skubick and Susan Demas and John Lindstrom. The NERD Fund, which was the Snyder administration's fund, comprised of anonymous donors whose contributions defrayed the cost of government, went the way of Skunk Works here a few weeks ago. This appears to have been an embarrassing lesson for the Snyder administration.
Lesson learned. The governor said, I didn't know all this stuff would happen if I created a fund and didn't release the names. And the interesting thing about it is senior advisors basically told him as he was pondering the creation of this, Governor, everybody does this, so just don't worry about it. What the governor lost control of this issue. And I think this could have been taken care of in a much quicker and neater way. It dragged on and dragged on, and it still does to this day. Now they've created a new fund, which will be, they tell us, transparent. Mm-hmm. And I said to the governor, why didn't you do that the first time? And that's when he said, because I was not a career politician. I'd never dealt with this sort of thing. But he had others around him who have, and maybe he didn't get good advice on this one.
So the political education of Rick Snyder continues.
Even as we speak.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for politicians to create these funds. Mark Schauer, his Democratic opponent, had one. I think the difference for Snyder and why he got so much blowback is that he ended up using the fund for people who were deeply involved, like Rich Baird, in creating policy and being part of his government. And that was being done with private funds, and nobody was knowing where it came from, what kinds of conflicts of interest there were. And that's why I think it sparked so much of a backlash.
As Tim pointed out, Mark Schauer, Democratic candidate for governor, quickly acknowledged that he used to have a similar fund years ago. Does that neutralize some political advantage that he might have been able to use
in
the
election? Well, he released the names of two people that were on the list, and then they said they had lost all the other ones. I don't know where they went.
Okay.
It neutralizes it slightly, but as Susan pointed out, you had the situation of Rich Baird, who was a key administration player, who was working for the public but being paid privately. And what the governor came into this as a business guy, and he tried to do things pretty much as business people do, which is you move quickly, you make a decision, you do this, you don't necessarily always worry about the public relations part of it until afterwards. And in politics, you really have to think about what's the public relations part of it before you go into it. And he did not do that.
Well, his problem was he ran on the issue of transparency. And this was anything but.
Oh yeah, I mean that's what I'm saying. If you're going to say that you're going to have a transparent administration, then you've got to make sure that what you're doing meets that definition of transparency.
Well, and then he had the problem. He said, "I promised these people I wouldn't release their names." Okay. Well, you know what? He could have gone back to them and said, "Look, I would like to release your name. If you give me your permission, I will. And if you don't, we won't."
Do you think that happened?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
It crossed my mind whether or not some of these supporters may self-identify in an effort to try to salvage something from
this
situation.
Just to tie this back into the Detroit bankruptcy case, part of the reason the union attorneys wanted to find out who was on the list to see if there were any favors that were done by Jones Day, the law firm, had they contributed to this fund, and they end up with a huge contract with the city of Detroit. And when the attorneys tried that in court the other day, the judge stepped in and said, out of bounds, which I thought was kind of interesting, because if you're trying to make the point that there was influence peddling going on, allegedly, how else do you find out than by looking at the fund?
Yeah.
And the judge said, we ain't going there. And the governor must have gone, whew, that was close. Although he said he didn't know any of the people in the fund to begin with.
Which
means he is pretty close to being a career politician. If you think about it.
He's learned quickly. Yeah.
He has learned quickly. I don't want to know who's on the list.
It's interesting to ponder money coming from Jones Day to the Nerd Fund to go back to Kevin Orr so he can fly back and forth to Washington, D.C. That is...
We do, let's be clear, we don't know.
We don't know that.
We don't know that, but that's what the attorneys wanted to find out.
Well, call me cynical, but can we assume that the transparent group will attract less cash?
That's hard to say. I mean, it may depend on whether or not the governor's reelected. The business community is very, very tied to him, and they're certainly going to support him as strongly as they can. And we'll see. We'll just see what happens once this election is over.
John, the Tea Party and its supporters are being widely blamed for the partial government shutdown that happened this month. How is that playing out more recently here in Michigan between mainstream Republicans and the Tea Party?
Well, in this state, nationally, you're starting to see, however you want to put them, the old guard, the establishment Republicans, basically fighting back to a certain degree. And one of the more vivid examples of this came actually a couple of months ago now, when Senator Howard Walker, who is not running for re-election, was at a function up in Traverse City, and one person who was there criticized him and others for being weak Republicans for supporting Medicaid expansion. And he's there at the microphone, and he says, screw you. And, you know, people were just stunned by that. And that, was sort of, in this state, maybe the most visible example. But you are now starting to see people, starting to fight back. Part of this is because the Tea Party has made Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly their target. Mm-hmm. They want him off. And they're going to make a major effort to try to convince the convention to knock him off and put one of their people on as Lieutenant Governor. In the 2014 election, there's been a lot of talk in the party about how do we finesse around this, try to protect the lieutenant governor, and this fight is now drawing. And now you're starting to see some of the Tea Party people, like Jack Hogendyke, putting up emails and other notices saying they're after us now. We have to step up. We have to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the issue for establishment Republicans who, were buoyed by Tea Party supporters in 2010 and 2012 to some degree, is that now when they want to fight back against what they think it has become a more destructive force, they still face a Republican primary situation where it's a very small cut of the electorate, 20% or less, and usually the rule is the most conservative candidate wins. That can often outdo the money being spent. And it's hard to outflank a Tea Party candidate and be more conservative than them. And so establishment Republicans may have a reckoning in 2014 in some of these primaries.
Quickly, let's go around the horn here. Your most underreported story for October, in your opinions?
I think this has been a very lackluster fall session for the legislature. There are 61 days left in the state of Michigan, and they will be in town a grand total of, count them, 18 days. We got to take care of hunting, and then, of course, there's Thanksgiving, and then there's Hanukkah, and then there's Christmas.
Wow.
So 18 days between now and the end of the year. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt that maybe they'll fund transportation. Anybody here believe in Santa Claus? They will have to fund the Medicaid expansion thing, which will be very contentious. So they could get some stuff done, but they aren't there yet.
Okay. Susan?
Well, my favorite unreported story comes from Oklahoma U.S. Senator Tom Coburn, who is not a fan of Michigan's national parks, apparently, and thinks that they are the ultimate symbol of government waste. He doesn't like Isle Royale. He doesn't like a copper mine site up in the UP. He even doesn't like the Sleeping Bear Dunes, which Good Morning America says is the most beautiful place in America. So I thought that was a little misplaced, and I'm sure he'll face a backlash.
Okay, John, quickly.
Something that's come up recently, so it's only underreported because it's just come up. But a bill in the Senate Energy Committee that would allow phone companies to end landlines, and this has become a very, very significant issue for older members of the state. The Attorney General is worried about it. The PSC has come out against it. AARP has warned legislators that they consider this a significant issue that they'll monitor in terms of things like endorsements.
I can't wait to see whether third graders in Michigan may have to repeat if their reading is not up to speed, too. We learned a lot more about that yesterday. John Lindstrom of Gongwer News, Susan Demas of Inside Michigan Politics Newsletter, and Tim Skubick of WKAR-TV's Off the Record. Many thanks to all of you. And now to the stars. Later this month, a rare treat will be streaking across the sky. Astronomers and amateur stargazers alike are waiting in anticipation for the comet Ison, which many are predicting will be bright enough to be seen with the naked eye. Here to talk comets and to tell us more about this identified flying object, John French, the interim director of MSU's Abrams Planetarium. Welcome to Current State, John.
Oh, thank you.
Let's revisit a couple of basics here. Tell us what a comet is exactly.
Well, comets are part of our solar system, and they travel around the sun, and they're made up mostly of ice and dirt and other things like that. They're a few miles across, so kind of think of them as a giant iceberg out in space floating around and being drawn in by the gravity of the sun, and they whip around the sun and head back out into deep space again.
And they have these dramatic tails often, or at least the ones that we've seen in pictures of in books.
Right, yeah. As the comet gets closer to the sun, that ice starts to melt essentially and gives off gases that trail behind it and leave that nice tail that you see coming from the back of the comet. Now, a lot of times comets are kind of confused with meteors. Meteors are quite different. They just zip through the sky very quickly, where a comet is something that will linger in the sky for several weeks or months perhaps, and you can go out and see it. So a common misconception is that you're going to go outside and see this comet streaking through the sky, but the comet really just kind of lingers there in the sky because it's moving very quickly around the sun. But from our viewpoint far away, it just seems to stay in the sky for quite mm-hmm. some time.
I meant to bring a photograph that I have on my desk into the studio here today just to get in with the spirit of the thing. And this is of the comet Hale-Bopp, which was very visible back in 97?
It was in the late 90s. Yeah, that was really the last really great comet that came by. There's been a few other ones that were bright enough that someone that really was looking for them could see. But Hale-Bopp was nice because you could just walk out there and look up in the sky and anybody could see it.
That cooperated beautifully.
Yes.
And there have been comets that have passed through our neighborhood here that have fizzled. I mean, I remember the comet Kohoutek from the 70s.
Oh, yeah, I remember Kohoutek as well.
Dramatic failure in terms of Skywatch.
Yes, well, that's the trouble with comets is they're very unpredictable, at least as far as their brightness is concerned. They're very predictable about where they will travel through space, but how bright they get is very unpredictable. And so this comet Ison it was first discovered about a year, about a year ago, and it was very far out. And for how far away it was quite bright for being that far away. So there was a lot of early predictions that said, "Oh, this could be the comet of the century." Well, you know, it's been getting brighter as it's been getting closer, but it really hasn't been getting as bright as quickly as some of the early predictions. And so we're really keeping our fingers crossed, hoping that this comet does become one of these nice naked eye comets.
Now, when, assuming we are able to see it, when will that happen?
Well, it's, it is visible now with a moderate sized telescope, and it is brightening as it gets closer to the sun, but it hopefully will be visible later in November and early December. Hopefully that's when it's thought to be at its brightest.
Mm-hmm. And we won't know how bright it is still for will we know how bright it's going to be before it gets here, or will we just have to wait and see?
Well, yeah, the astronomers now are watching it, and, you know, every day as it gets a little bit closer and closer to the sun, it gets a little bit brighter, and you can kind of watch the graph on how bright it gets. But sometimes they'll outgas and give off extra gases and things that cause a sudden brightening. But
like a flare?
Kind of like a flare,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything science can learn from ISON?
Well, ISON is a comet that was thought to come from the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is a big cloud of particles that are, comet nuclei that are going around our solar system real far out. And it's thought to be the remains of the original nebula that the solar system formed from.
Mm-hmm.
And so when these comets that are first-time visitors to the inner solar system come by, they do have a lot of material that would have been left over from those early days. And so it is interesting to astronomers to try to study some of the chemical makeup of these mm-hmm. comets.
I think, the most legendary comet that I think most people are aware of is Halley's Comet. How does ISON compare to Halley's Comet?
Yeah, Halley's Comet, which will come back in 2061, so mark your calendars for that. That one is one that comes around about every 75 years, and it doesn't go out nearly as far as the Oort cloud. It probably originated from the Oort cloud, but, you know, centuries ago, thousands of years ago, it probably passed close enough to Jupiter that it perturbed its orbit and put it into this little small orbit, small being every 75 years as opposed to every 10,000 years or something. Mm. And but that one, Halley's Comet, is quite bright when it comes around and quite spectacular.
And you have a program going on right now at the Abrams Planetarium, Comets and Discovery. What a
yes.
coincidence. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, the current show that we're running at the planetarium is called Comets and Discovery, and it talks about the history of comets and the history of comet hunting, a thing that a lot of astronomers do and a lot of amateur astronomers is to hunt for comets and try to find these new comets that are heading in. And this show talks a little bit about the history of how people have hunted for comets.
How does an amateur discover a comet?
Well, the traditional way is to just get out there with your telescope and scan the skies very meticulously, looking at parts of the sky that you're familiar with. And when you see a little speck in your telescope that you didn't see there the night before, it could be a comet. Then you watch it over the course of a few nights, and if it slowly moves, after enough observations, you can calculate its orbit and determine whether it's a comet or a new comet that's never been seen before.
Very interesting. And this has a unique history as well. One of the more renowned comet hunters that you talk about in your program is a woman from the 1700s, Caroline Herschel. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Caroline Herschel, she was the sister of the more famous
William
Herschel,
yeah,
who discovered Uranus. And they were a brother and sister team that did a lot of astronomy. And she was an avid observer herself and spent a lot of time just hunting for comets. And there's, quite a few, about six or so comets that still bear her name that she was the discoverer of.
So there are comet hunters have been around for centuries.
Yes.
What you're saying.
Yes.
Now, and how long does your show at Abrams Planetarium run? This is Comets and discovery.
Yeah, well, the program itself goes for about an hour. We have a live section that we do in the show where we talk about Comet Ison and how to observe it, and we also have a little segment about Comet Halley and what that's going to be like when it comes back. But we'll be running this show up until the holiday season, when we'll switch over to our holiday show called Season of Light.
Season of Light. That's a legendary show at Abrams Planetarium.
Yes, we bring it back every year.
That's right. And give us the time window again before once again. Comet Ison, likely to be most visible.
Yeah, it'll be most visible late November, and it actually goes around the sun on Thanksgiving Day. So when you're eating your Thanksgiving turkey, know that there's a comet passing very close to the sun. Now, this comet is a sun-grazing comet, which means it gets very close to the sun. So one thing that we're not sure about is, will it survive? It's really close past to the sun. If it survives, when it comes out the first week or two of December is when it's expected to be at its brightest, and it starts to head more in the direction of the Earth.
But we don't know whether it'll survive.
It might not survive.
Like the wings of the phoenix here.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Okay. It is just a big iceberg a few miles across, and the sun is pretty hot, and the heat and the cold will react.
We got into the lexicography here of these objects here just a minute ago. Tell us where asteroids figure into this.
Right. Well, asteroids tend to be more of a rocky type material, and the typical asteroid is in the asteroid belt, which is a zone between Mars and Jupiter, and they're in a more circular orbit going around the sun, whereas the comets tend to be in long elliptical orbits that come from deep space, go very close to the sun, and head back out into deep space.
And what were asteroids created from?
Well, they were probably also just part of the original solar nebula when the solar system formed, and as particles were coalescing around the sun, planets formed in some parts of the solar system, but in that zone between Jupiter and Mars, a planet didn't form. Instead, we ended up with a lot of little small chunks of rock.
Very interesting. John French, we appreciate your time. John's the interim director of MSU's Abrams Planetarium. We've been talking about the comet Ison. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Each month, Current State weekend host Emmanuel Berry sits down with historian David Vada to rediscover forgotten bits of Michigan's history. Vada is the community engagement librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services. This month, they decided to discuss the history of werewolves in Michigan. Yes, there is a history. In fact, according to legends, werewolves have been around Michigan for a long time. We're talking before Cadillac, back to the 1690s, when a young nun became the object of a voyager's affections. David explains what a nun has to do with werewolves.
This comes from the French pioneer period, so we're late 17th century, and there were the Europeans settling around Lake St. Clair. And they brought their legends with them from the old world. I mean, we're still just a generation removed from the height of the witch craze in Europe. So people that they knew could very well have been involved in the persecution of witches and werewolves there. They come to the New World and they bring their stories with them. The story revolves around a young woman who was living in what is now Grosse Pointe. And she was pure of heart and wanted to become a nun. And there is this lascivious woodsman who takes a shine to her, and he tries to woo her, and she wants nothing to do with him. And she's just explaining, you know, she's devoting herself to the Catholic Church. He takes none of that and goes to find what is described as a Native American witch, that's a kind of transposing of cultures right there. And she brokers a deal between him and Satan and gives him the power to turn into a wolf. She has been praying at a rock on Lake St. Clair as an altar.
This is the nun. The nun has been praying.
Yes. And she's traveling through the woods. She's going to become a nun, and he finds her alone in the wilderness, and he transforms and begins chasing her. And he goes, and as he touches the rock that she has been praying at, he's transformed to stone.
So it's a kind of a play almost on Medusa in some ways.
It's an allegory. Mm-hmm. She is, you know, it's about the duality of man, good versus evil, and also that in nature she is frolicking in the benevolent nature and is pure. He is all the carnal bad parts of us. I mean, many werewolf stories are based around concepts of serial killers and the base animalistic part of us, and that's where that comes from.
And you already kind of touched on it a little bit, but it's a strange mix. We've got this Native American element in there, this French folklore. What type of Native American legends talk about werewolves, or is that even a thing, really?
Not like that. I mean, in the Southwest, you have the Skinwalkers. It's a very different culture. The Mohawks had a variation of warriors that could turn into wolves, but they were not evil at all. It was an aspirational. They were good. They took on the good, courageous parts of a wolf. The closest they would come would be something like a Wendigo, which is more of a vampire ghoul. They are associated with cannibalism. They're associated with the north and winter, late winter. They had a taboo against cannibalism. Mm-hmm. And so the Wendigo can be interpreted two ways. It can be as a cautionary tale that don't eat human flesh or you turn into the Wendigo, or an explanation that in the end of winter when there's starvation and famine and there's nothing else to eat, and there are those that have not been buried yet because of the winter, you do have to partake in that to survive. And it's explained away because it wasn't you that did it. You were consumed by the Wendigo, and it was the Wendigo that did it.
Kind of interestingly, at the time when there's sort of this shift in the werewolf legends from French to in imposing kind of them onto Native American legends, there's actual werewolf-like activities, I guess, going on in France. There's this man-eating, wolf-like animal that's terrorizing the province of Govendon. It's injuring hundreds of people, and this is documented. This is not like a made-up story. So what is going on here?
All the facts aren't out, but in the 1760s, there was a series of events, and it's wrapped around this beast of Govendon, and it was described as a large wolf-like animal, sometimes with a long tail, and there were 60 to 100 people killed over a number of years. The creature has large teeth, and there's been a lot of conjecture. Was it some sort of dire wolf holdover from prehistoric times? Was it a big cat? Was it a hyena? That's been conjecture. Was it some sort of wolf-mastiff hybrid? What supposedly happens is it was killed, and there are two dissecting stories about this. One is that it was identified as a wolf, and it was put on display. There are other stories that it was identified as a hyena at that point and also put on display, but it's also been the body was destroyed. And later on, there was legend about it being wrapped in, it was shot by a silver bullet. But that is until much later that story comes in. But there were dozens of people killed by this creature, and we still don't know what it was. That's a real story.
Now, another legend close to home, and this is one that many Michiganders have probably heard of, and that is the myth of the Dog Man, which is chronicled in the 1987 song, The Legend. We'll play a little bit of that here.
The decades come, the decades go, people still swear they see. Interlock and Reed City, Mackinac, there was something looking back at me. And somewhere in the Northwoods darkness, a creature walks upright. And the best advice you may ever get is don't go out at night.
The song, The Legend, there, that song was originally aired kind of as an April Fool's prank, but after it played, many people called into the station about the song. So I want to go back to the origins of Dogman, and that's all the way back into the 1880s. So how does this myth of the Dogman come to be?
It actually being called the Dog Man isn't until modern times. Mm-hmm. But what they, the people in mostly this is northwestern Michigan, kind of like Manistee forest, they still had the legends, these French pioneer legends of werewolves and lumberjacks. You know, sometimes a wolf was caught in a trap and its foot was cut off, and then the lumberjacks come back to camp and they realize that one of the other lumberjacks has his hand cut off. And so when the story evolved in around the song, they transposed these werewolf stories onto the Dogman legend. So that's mm-hmm. where the Dogman has come from. And there's a series of books that have been put out about it. And it shows up in cryptozoology books. You know, also in Wisconsin, there are stories about a similar creature.
Why do you think these legends about werewolves persist? And in particular, why did they persist in Michigan?
We have a cultural heritage. It's bringing with the stories the where our forebears had these part of them. It's the same thing as fairy tales. I mean, you know, for generation after generation, you tell the same stories. And around campfires at night, you've heard a story from your grandfather or another person that it's a good story to tell.
David Vada is the Community Engagement Librarian at the Midwest Collaborative for Library Services, and he's a historian. You'll hear more from David in the coming months as part of Current State's Forgotten History segment.
Even the man whose heart is pure and says his prayers at night can change to a wolf when the wolf bane blooms and the full moon shining bright.
And now for Halloween, Current State contributor Scott Southard remembers a lost classic.
Christmas has A Christmas Carol, It's a Wonderful Life, Miracle on 34th Street. Halloween has a collection of monsters stolen from black and white horror movies and a long history with witches and the like. But when it comes to an actual story, a fable to be brought out each year with the pumpkins, the holiday is sadly lacking. In 1972, Ray Bradbury saw this problem and created what is now, in my opinion, a lost classic, The Halloween Tree. Some might know this story only because of a bad animated cartoon. Besides the thrill of hearing Bradbury's narration, the cartoon is a disaster and definitely doesn't live up to the potential of this metaphor-rich story. Skip it. Grab the book. The Halloween Tree is the story of 8 friends who are searching for their lost friend Pipkin on Halloween. Their investigation leads them to a gloriously gothic haunted house with a tree covered in lit jack-o'-lanterns. It is there, at this mysterious location, that the children meet Carapace Clavico Monchrode, a Willy Wonka-like character who offers to help them find their friend, but they need to learn the truth about Halloween first. From there, we are taken on a tour of Halloween and Halloween-like celebrations from around the world in time, from ancient Egypt to modern-day Mexico. The Halloween Tree argues that the holiday is more than simply an excuse for candy. It is a celebration of death, and such a macabre celebration helps us think about what it means to be alive. For a writer who claimed to be immortal, a favorite story Bradbury loved to tell people, which sadly was proven false, his perspective on life and death is wonderful. See, in the book, he takes the concept of death and the ending of one's own life from a personal to a global discussion. It moves the conversation from I will die to we all will die. And what does that mean about life? Not an easy task to do. So the fact Bradbury can do it so effortlessly in a young adult novel shows how masterful a storyteller he was. To emphasize this point about life and death and our united experience with it, the children at the end have to make an incredibly difficult choice. In order to save their friend Pipkin, they each have to give up 1 year of their own lives. What a terrifically morbid idea. And this is in a young adult book. For some reason, I imagine Bradbury laughing evilly and rubbing his hands together when he came up with the idea. Heck, I would have. This is not to say the book is perfect. Like most Bradbury, I feel he rushes to the big moments, not taking the time to dive into the characters and plots more. Also, the children other than the lead kind of blend into each other because he really doesn't define their characters. Even Bradbury has problems tying them apart, and sometimes he'll just have them all speak together, not even bothering to break down who is saying what. Yet, over time, I hope this book will grow, and Monstrode becomes as important to Halloween as Scrooge is to Christmas. Who knows? There is a chance. Just a few years ago, Disneyland created its own Halloween tree, mirroring the one in the book. Bradbury was even there to mark the day. Now the big question. Would I give up a year of my life to save a friend? Possibly. Honestly, it really matters who, because I like my life. But would I give up a year of my life to have thought up the last line in this book before Bradbury did? Definitely. At 2 a.m, the wind came back for more leaves. For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
Current State contributor Scott Southard is author of the novels A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and the Case of the Dangerous Dare. More of his writing can be found at his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, live music with the band Mahogany. Also, we speak with Wayne Kuipers of Energy Choice Now about electric choice in Michigan. All that and more Friday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl, and to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabrielle Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Happy Halloween. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.